There's a vanishing act going on in newsrooms around the country. A writer at the Salt Lake Tribune has compiled a list of 28 movie critics who have disappeared from major news outlets in cities including Atlanta, Denver, New York, and Tampa. Well, we asked NPR's David Folkenflik to figure out where all the critics have gone.
So let's say you're up for a movie. At this theater in Midtown Manhattan, there's Nim's Island, Persepolis, Deception. If there were only a way to pick, how to choose?
Oh, trailers. Trailers on TV. Friends telling me that these movies are right.
From the trailer.
Advertising trailer.
Right. That's how. I talked to a couple dozen people at this big megaplex, and most said pretty much what you just heard there from Gabrielle Collier, Sabrina Suarez, and Masha Compera. No one mentioned a critic. The film director Billy Ray says when studios are making trailers for turkeys, they can shop around for a positive blurb.
It may be from chickflix.com or harrysmovies.com, but people don't look at where the quotes are coming from. They just look at a quote that says, exhilarating.
What happened to the movie critics? Used to be big-name reviewers like Jack Matthews set the tone.
Newspapers have always had this sort of arrangement with Hollywood that they would run the reviews on the day the movies opened. And the readers have been sort of trained to look for the reviews on the day of opening. But now you've got all these people on the internet, many of them anonymous, who somehow get into early screenings, write reviews, and they go online.
Matthews retired a few months ago from the New York Daily News after decades as a critic. He was being steered toward writing more celebrity features. He says two names trump all others in movie reviewing.
RottenTomatoes.com and Metacritic.com.
The sites compile all the reviews from the pros and, Matthews would argue, from the schmoes.
It just steals the thunder of the critic.
It's not just the thunder that's being stolen. Newspaper profits are eroding badly. Sean McIntosh is an editor down at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and her title is, I'm not kidding, the Director of Culture and Change. She says editors are being forced to make tough decisions.
They're very concerned not only about their own personal livelihood, but about the role of news in a democracy and the role of a newspaper and a news institution like this in a society.
Last year, the Journal Constitution restructured its entire staff to focus more on the website and gave people buyouts to leave. Among them was the lead movie critic. McIntosh says that's a loss, but she says they can use reviews from other papers.
We need to have our local news gathering resources telling the stories for our local readers of our local market.
You could tell the same story about the fading of newspaper criticism about classical music, dance, or books, but it can make or break a movie. Billy Ray is the director of the film Breach. It's a true story character study about a young FBI agent assigned to trap a traitor.
I remember very clearly having a conversation with the studio in which I said to them, we have nothing in this movie to hang our hat on except the performances. This is a totally review-driven movie. Nothing blows up. Nobody chases each other with guns. There's no nudity. This is all we've got.
Ray resisted cutting scenes, saying that would have weakened the actors' performances for the audiences and for critics.
I think that's going to be a tougher and tougher argument to make when you're trying to defend your movie in the coming years if there are less critics out there who matter.
And that's a problem, even for Jeffrey Wells, who blogs at HollywoodElsewhere.com.
It's catastrophic, and it's something that has, I think, diminished the sense of film culture that we all kind of share in.
And yet, when he thinks about criticism online...
In a way, it's the best time ever for people who want to write about movies because they're so easy to find their viewpoints.
Especially from far-flung publications. Wells says the distance has collapsed in another way, too, as readers post instant and sometimes raucous feedback.
People are much less willing to accept that, you know, lordly wisdom from on high.
Catastrophe, the golden age, the rabble storming the gates. I got to tell you, this story of the disappearing critic, it makes for a roller coaster ride. Hey, that'd make a pretty good trailer. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
The new Chronicles of Narnia movie hits theaters this week. It's called Prince Caspian. The series is adapted from the beloved books for kids by C.S. Lewis. They start with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. This movie, Prince Caspian, is darker, more violent than either the books or the first movie. Andrew Adamson directed both Narnia movies, and he's with us now from New York. Hi there.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Good, thanks. Now, this movie's rated PG, but it's a movie about war. Let's listen to a clip. A lot of violence on screen there, and yet it's a kid's movie, Andrew Adamson.
You know, I would say there's a lot of action. I was interested in your comment that you said it was more violent than the book. And yet I remember very well reading the book as an 8-year-old and the line where Peter strikes out his legs and with the backstroke of the same sword stroke wallops off his head. I think that's a little more violent than anything that that I put in the movie. But it is, the action is definitely more intense than the last film. At the same time, the killing of Aslan in the last film was a very dark moment and something I think was quite scary for a lot of kids. But I think kids like to be scared as long as you don't leave them in that state for too long.
There's a lot in the movie that's not in the book. A big battle sequence at the evil King Miraz's castle. Why did you decide to include it in the movie?
I wanted to expand upon the book. You know, I said in the beginning of the last one that I wanted to make my memory of the book rather than the book itself. And my memory had expanded the book over the years so that when I went back and read it, it was much smaller than I thought. And every occasion I try and draw from the book and expand upon that.
You created new emotional storylines as well. There's Caspian's conflict with Peter and what seems to be sort of a budding romance with Susan.
Yeah, in the same way as I wanted to expand on the locations, expand on the action, I also wanted to create a three-dimensionality to the characters. You know, last time through, I found that when I read the book, Edmund was a bad boy, and I wanted to investigate why he was a bad boy and came upon this idea that his father was away at war. He was resenting his older brother. In this case, it was sort of the same thing, is how could I find a three-dimensionality to these characters that also fitted the story? And what I tried to do is treat it as if this was an event that had really happened, of which C.S. Lewis wrote a children's book, and I was going to make a movie of the real event. And that meant that the characters wanted to behave more like real characters with more dimensionality and the kind of interactions you would expect with kids that have grown up a little bit. You know, people have asked me about the element of an attraction between Caspian and Susan. I was like, well, Susan's 16 years old. Caspian's, you know, 17 or 18. They're both cute. It would be really odd if they weren't attracted to each other.
Yeah, I felt like Peter, Edmund, Susan, Lucy, the main four characters in the Narnia books, are definitely more three-dimensional in this book. If anything, it's Caspian that is the least developed character.
Caspian's dealing with, I think, somewhat of a more symbolic issue. I think it'd be true to say the Pevensies have more subtle issues they're dealing with. You know, Peter dealing with the fact that he was king of Narnia 15 years and he had to go back and do his homework all of a sudden. That was a pretty life-changing event. He's trying to reclaim his glory days. Susan with this slightly more subtle idea of not wanting to accept Narnia again because it was so hard for her to say goodbye last time. Caspian's story is a little more Shakespearean. You know, he's somebody who finds out his uncle is trying to kill him to gain his throne and throughout the film learns that his uncle also killed his father. It's sort of a bigger, darker issue to deal with. In some ways, that sort of sets off the tone of the film being darker. But you're right, it's a little harder to relate to as a daily experience. Most of us, fortunately, don't have to deal with those kind of issues.
Now, C.S. Lewis's stepson, Douglas Gresham, is a co-producer in the Narnia movies. What did he think of the changes you made?
He was always very good with them. The only thing I think that Doug and I ever really argued about on both of these films was about the role that I allowed women to play in the film, or particularly the girls to play. Hmm. In the first book, Father Christmas gives Susan a bow and arrow and says, I do not intend you to use them. And I found that incredibly disempowering. The fact that I have two young daughters and have a lot of strong women in my life, there was no way I was going to tell that story. I thought Father Christmas would probably have given her a knife and plate and said, there you go, go make sandwiches, because in the book that was all she was allowed to do. And I just really wanted the female characters in the story to be as empowered as the male.
And Douglas Gresham did not?
He felt like I was deviating from C.S. Lewis's ideas, which is true, but C.S. Lewis wrote these books a long time ago. And I also pointed out that he wrote the first few of these books before he met Doug's mother, because Doug's C.S. Lewis' stepson. And when you read some of the later books in the series, like Horse and His Boy, he does actually have stronger female characters than he did in these first few.
Now, the Christian themes are really clear in the C.S. Lewis books. Do you think about those themes when you're putting this on screen?
I'm certainly aware of them. I'm aware of them from the point of view of not wanting to take anything away too much from people who love them because of the theology. At the same time, I read the books when I was 8 years old before I even knew what the word allegory meant. And I read them for what they were, which is great adventures based on, in many cases, a lot of mythology. And that was first and foremost what I wanted to stay true to, is just kind of being true to the book and then letting people interpret the movies in the same way that people have interpreted the books differently over the years.
It's interesting that Aslan plays such a small role in this book, the lion of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, he's a small role in the book and in some ways was a slightly smaller role in the film, although I think he has a lot of presence in the film and there's certainly an awareness of him throughout. there's less actual screen time, and it was one of the problems I came to adapting it. I found that in the movie, if Aslan showed up too soon and didn't do anything, there was just that big question of, well, why are these guys even going to war anymore? Why doesn't he just come in and save the day? So we sort of had to come up with some solutions to get around that, which did mean that he doesn't really show up till later in the story than perhaps he did in the book.
And yet that's part of the point, isn't it? It's about having faith in Aslan, getting back to those Christian themes.
It's certainly, yeah, it's faith and belief in something beyond yourself is a big part of the story.
Andrew Adamson directed the new movie, The Chronicles of Narnia, Prince Caspian. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, Andrew.
Hollywood rolls out the blockbuster event movies in the summer, and in the next few months there will be plenty of explosions on screen and the special effects that go great with popcorn. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition critic Kenneth Turan can't wait.
I know, I'm a critic. I'm only supposed to enjoy the serious Oscar contenders that come out in the fall. But this summer, I'm really looking forward to what director Christopher Nolan and Batman Christian Bale have cooked up for The Dark Knight. And who wouldn't want to see the first Indiana Jones film in nearly 20 years? It used to be that I'd get this excited every summer. But as the movies became increasingly tailored to young males, it put a crimp into my favorite ritual, walking through theater lobbies and looking at the posters for upcoming summer films. In some years, the movies were so mindless that I couldn't find a film I even wanted to see, let alone review. This summer has as many blockbuster movies as ever, but the studios are getting smarter about who is going to direct and star in them. After all, if you're going to do comic book movies, why not give them to someone as gifted as Guillermo del Toro, the director of Hellboy 2? And if you have to do comedies, and I guess you do, why not give the stars roles they're suited for? This summer, Will Smith as cranky superhero Hancock looks especially funny.
You save people's lives every single day. People should love you.
I look like I care what people think.
Even Adam Sandler looks promising as a Mossad assassin turned Manhattan hairdresser in You Don't Mess With the Zohan.
You have never cut hair before.
I will do whatever it takes.
Okay.
My fingers are crossed, of course, that these movies are actually good. About the only sure thing Hollywood has this summer is a new animated film from Pixar about a robot named Wall-E. Even if you mess with the Zohan, you don't want to get in Pixar's way.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
Think back to the last film that you saw by a Chinese filmmaker with a Chinese cast depicting some aspect of Chinese life. If one came to mind, maybe it was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or House of Flying Daggers, maybe Farewell, My Concubine. One thing all those films have in common, along with most Chinese films we get here in the States, is that they don't really show us anything about modern life in the People's Republic of China. Those realities are often left to China's independent filmmakers, a scene not just underground in mainland China, but technically illegal. That's because some of what's depicted in these films doesn't quite jibe with the Communist Party line. But some independent films are starting to make it into American markets, offering for the first time a candid look behind China's bamboo curtain. Jian Yi is an independent filmmaker based in Beijing. He's the director of the new feature documentary called Supergirls, currently screening around the country. And he joins us here in the studio along with Karen Chien. She's the president of Degenerate Films, a New York-based distributor of independent Chinese films. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you. It's our pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us.
I want to start with you, Jian Yi. Your film Supergirls follows some 80,000 young girls who are dreaming of being on this show, Supergirl Singing Contest. So naturally, in America, we think, oh, this is like Chinese American Idol. Is that essentially what it's like?
The Supergirl Singing Contest was modeled on the Pop Idol in the UK and American Idol in the US. So it started in 2004 at a TV program in the province. And it was very successful. So they made it a national program on 2005. And in 2005, it was so successful that 400 million people watch it.
400 million people?
Wow. Yeah, in that year.
Huh.
And then the champion of that year appeared on the cover of the Time magazine and became one of the 10 or 20 Asian heroes of that year.
Let's kind of set the scene a little bit. Let's play a clip of some of the girls warming up for their audition performances. And the songs, they sing everything. They sing everything from Chinese pop to American pop hits, even rap. Let's take a listen.
Have you gotten over? Have you started a brand new life? Have you met somebody, someone who's starting there, someone unlike me?
为什么他听见爱上他的到底在想什么？他是否知道帅哥不能爱是什么？让他忘了放纵，不知道该做什么。我说的怎么可能？So there, we just heard a lot of different kinds of music. I mean, we heard people singing in English. We heard some rapping. It's a wide range. It was such a popular show that so many people voted and participated in this that there was a lot of writing that happened that said, oh, this is the most democracy that China has seen ever.
Well, it is one of the most important cultural phenomena in the recent years. It's a TV program that has a democratic aspect to it. In part of my show, I filmed how the girls were rallying votes for their heroes on the street. You know, this is something that when I was filming it, you know, I was very, very surprised. I'm impressed because, you know, never before in my life had I seen anyone rallying any votes on the street, you know, in a very spontaneous way.
Campaigning, essentially.
Yeah, like campaigning. I've never seen that before.
Why did you decide that this would make a good idea for a film to follow these, you say, 10 or so people who are taking part in this? What triggered your imagination?
I think even in the independent filmmaking world, people tend to make films more about the marginalized people and underprivileged people, which I think is very important, you know, to represent their voices. But the thing is that, you know, then, on the other hand, the mainstream culture in China is somehow underrepresented because, you know, you either see the mainstream Chinese culture from the government channel or you don't see much from an independent perspective. This show was on in 2005, was very popular, and it started in June, and many of my friends were watching it. And I thought, you know, at the beginning, I thought it was too vulgar to watch it. You know, just, you know, terribly superficial. I thought it seemed to me very girlish, very, you know, it's only for girls. It's not like the American Idol, it's for both gender. And then I watched one of the shows in July, and my butt was glued to the couch for the rest of the season.
So why? What was so compelling about it that time?
Because I've never seen such spontaneous things before, and I've never seen such participation in a TV show before.
Huh.
So, you know, I also, you know, I've never voted in my life for anyone, but I, you know, in that year, I started voting for the girl I liked. Thing I liked.
Describe that feeling.
You feel you can make a difference. You know, you feel like never before that you can make a difference. Hmm. You know, in somebody else's life, and you know your vote counts. That's how you felt. You know, I don't know what
how
is really behind
is, yeah.
the scene, but that's how you felt.
Well, let's talk about how this show can potentially change someone's life. You mentioned the winner in 2005 was on the cover of Time magazine. And was made a national star. What are the motivations that these girls have? The best case scenario would be what? They would be a major Chinese pop star, or do they get a record deal?
The thing is that once you become one of the top 10 of the national final, you have to sign a contract with a TV station. It's compulsory. I don't remember, it's 10 years or 20 years. So for
that
the next
seriously
10 or
changes
yeah,
your life.
Yeah, for the next 10 or 20 years, you are on a contract with this TV station.
What has been the reception? You've been touring around the States and screening the film at different universities. How have people reacted to it?
I think most of them were very surprised to see China in that kind of perspective. You know, many of them commented saying that, you know, this is not very different than America or than the American Idol.
I want to bring Karen into the conversation. To talk a little more about some of the obstacles involved in independent filmmaking in China. In the intro to this segment, we referenced the fact that doing this. Independent filmmaking is technically illegal. Can you explain that?
The filmmaking industry in China is governed in a large part by the state, as are other businesses in China. And in order to get a film made, the script has to go through the censorship board and the approval, as well as the final film. You know, you need permits from the government, so on and so forth. So the act of making a film has to be approved each step of the way by the government. So when you are making a film about content that the government might find unpleasant or disagreeable in some way, you're not going to necessarily get that approval.
So, Jian, how have you dealt with that? I mean, have you felt like people have been monitoring your work?
No.
Since you're operating under the radar, so to speak.
No. I think the government thinks that people don't watch documentaries anyway.
Oh, they think they're irrelevant.
So, yeah. So, you know, they think people don't watch documentaries anyway. So they don't monitor it as much.
I mean, in essence, filmmaking, independent filmmaking in China is quote-unquote underground. There's a whole system of production, distribution, exhibition that is under the radar, I would say. For example, the way that a lot of documentaries are made, it really is literally just one person. I mean, here in the States, it might be five people, but you're just talking about the filmmaker, and that's it. So if you have a filmmaker running around with a mini DV camera, you know, it's pretty much under the radar. The films, I would say, don't have a huge chance to get outside the country other than through programmers, festival programmers that are looking for content, actively looking for content in China, or sometimes visiting scholars. And also through cultural institutions. I think that Europe and other parts of the world are much farther ahead than the U.S. is in terms of sourcing content from China or showing interest in independent films from China. So I think that...
Why is that?
I think that's a good question. I actually went to China and started asking people that too. And I said, why are there no Americans here looking for your films? Because it's very fascinating what's happening in independent film in China right now. It's very new. There's very little infrastructure. The cinema that's happening is very risk-taking. The content's very interesting. There's a huge amount of interest in China, in the U.S., but there's maybe just a mental obstacle into getting into China. And I spoke to a number of American distributors and asked them if they're looking at Chinese content. And their answer was usually, no, we already already are sourcing content from Hong Kong and Japan and Korea, which of course does not speak to the kind of content that's coming out of mainland China.
What are the films that we're getting as American film consumers? And what is that telling us about China?
We get maybe the one independent filmmaker whose films come to the U.S., by the name of Jia Zhangke, and his films, you know, they win prizes at Venice, and, you know, he has a film at Cannes this year, so he's probably the most internationally recognized independent filmmaker in China right now. On top of his maybe one film every 2 years that we get, we also see, you know, films that really are martial arts spectacles, epics, historical epics. You know, I kind of feel like we know much more about China in the last few centuries than we do about China in the last few decades.
Are they reinforcing or debunking stereotypes that Americans have about China?
Those films are definitely not spreading information about what China is like, I would say, on a diverse level. You know, when you watch a martial arts film, what does Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon really tell you about China? Especially modern day China. Absolutely nothing about modern day China.
I want to thank both of you for coming in. We really appreciate it. Jian Yi is an independent filmmaker based in Beijing. He's the director of the new feature documentary Supergirls. And Karen Chien is the president of Degenerate Films, a New York-based distributor of independent Chinese films. Thanks to you both for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.